On today's episode, Brad and I get a chance to talk about foreign transaction fees. Have you ever wondered how should I be withdrawing money when I need it while traveling internationally? We're going to share the right way to do it, and I will also share how I have been doing it wrong this entire time. Jordan calls in to share how he was able to drastically reduce his 401k fees. Jennifer and Kara weigh in on FI if you have a chronic healthcare condition. And Jared from Fifth Wheel PT shares how him and his girlfriend are traveling the world for 5 months, visiting 11 countries for a total of, get this, less than $6,000. Welcome to the ultimate crowdsourced personal finance show. This is your Friday Roundup.
You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI. Your home for financial independence online.
All right, guys, really excited to hop into this episode. As I kind of talked about in the beginning, we did bring Jared on to highlight some actionable tips that he used to travel the world at a fraction of the cost of what you would actually expect. We're going to be rolling out, I wanted to say unpack. Could you hear how badly I wanted to say unpack? We're going to be rolling out that entire segment later on in this episode. But I think it's a great time to have this conversation because Brad and I are releasing this while we're actually in Greece for Chautauqua. And this is going to be a lot of fun, but I think it presents a lot of opportunity to talk about some very small optimizations as you plan to do some foreign travel. To help me with this, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan, I'm doing well. Yeah, that's so funny. It reminds me of the great unpack scandal of 2017.
Right? When I realized that that was my go-to default word. I still love it, but now I hold it in reserve. Like one, I can use it one time every like 2 to 3 episodes. That's kind of what I try to average now.
Nice. Very, very nice. And yeah, like you mentioned, we are currently, when this is being released, we're in Greece for the Chautauqua. And yeah, I mean, I think both of us had different ways. We're trying to figure out, okay, what do we do about currency? So Alan Donegan told us we probably need to have some euros to maybe pay for cabs, or possibly there are some instances where you won't be able to use credit card all the time, though at our resort, we will be able to. But you certainly need to have currency. And I know I just went to Europe a couple of months ago. I went to the UK and I didn't have a good answer. And stupidly, incredibly, I didn't ask anybody, right? We have so many people in our community who are world travelers, who are brilliant, who have optimizations. And stupidly, I went to my Wells Fargo. I walked up and said, hey, I need some pounds.
Wait a second. Hey, I just want to preface. That was literally what I did this time. So I loved how you prefaced the stupid part. That was my actual strategy. Are you telling me there's a better way?
There is a better way. So unsurprisingly.
Well, let's just start with, what's the problem with just going to Wells Fargo? Why would someone not just want to go, hey, do you guys have some euros? I'll trade you some dollars from some euros. Now I'm good to go.
I found, and this is anecdotal, so take it for what it's worth. You might find a better situation with your bank or et cetera, but a couple of issues. So I had to decide at that very moment how many pounds I needed to buy. And I had no sense of what my actual needs were. So I just got like 300 pounds, which is $400. And I had no clue if I was actually going to need 20, 40 or 700, right? So that was kind of annoying. There was a transaction fee just to basically purchase pounds. So it was like a shipping fee. That is just completely wasted. I hate paying fees, Jonathan. I hate it. So whenever I see a fee, I know that I did something wrong or didn't plan well. So that was annoying. I found that I didn't get the best exchange rate at that moment. When I checked on Google when I got home, the exchange rate that I got seemed to be worse than what was being reported as the current spot rate for the currency translation. So that was annoying. And I had to wait 5 business days or something like that. It was a couple of business days. It wasn't instant. So for all those reasons, it was suboptimal at best.
So, all right. So I just did this. So when I went to Wells Fargo, I'm standing there and I'm looking at the transaction fees. And I think at that time, and there's some variance here depending on the day, but I think it was, they will sell me at a 1 to 1.3 ratio for a euro. But if I'm trying to sell back, so, you know, we didn't end up using it all. Can I say, hey guys, I don't need all this. Can I give it back to you and get some dollars back? They will buy it at, I believe it was a 1.15. That's the exchange ratio when you're trying to give your money back to them. So there's clearly a discrepancy. How bad did I actually do, Brad, in real dollars?
Wow. That's pretty significant. That's $15 per 100 euros difference, basically. And that's just straight up fee. That's crazy. If you, right, if you bought 100 euros, that would cost you 130 US dollars at the 1.3. And when you sell it back, you would sell 100 euros, let's say, for argument's sake, and only get $115. So that's $15 difference on the 130 that you originally spent. So if I'm looking at the numbers right, that's an 11%+ transaction fee right there, just for their lovely right to buy and sell. So yeah, that is not ideal, obviously. And then, like I said, there's also that shipping fee and such. So
if anyway, you get like, but to the point, if you get like a five, if you say, oh, well, I'm just going to get the money ahead of time, I'm going to get $500 or $1,000 or convert that to euros. I mean, you're talking about just for the privilege of now having currency in the right denominations and in the right, you know, and for the right country, that's $50 to $100 that you just lost just by converting to the correct country's currency.
Yeah. And making a suboptimal decision to go to your bank and do it that way. And I think what I learned just the other day, I had sent an email to some of the people from Chautauqua. Luckily, Bryce from Millennial Revolution emailed me back almost instantly and said, hey, dude, you need to use the Schwab High Yield Investor Checking. It's a slam dunk. And he sent me an article that they wrote. And actually, Sun Wu, one of the moderators of our Facebook group, sent me an article that he wrote as well on best bank accounts. And we'll link both of them up certainly in the show notes here, where Sun Wu described both the Schwab account and a Fidelity account that's called the cash management account. It's amazing. It alleviates all these fees, all the need to do this in advance. You basically open up, in this case, Schwab. I opened up a checking account. It took me about 5 minutes since I already have other Schwab accounts. So at the same time, they open a brokerage account and this checking account for you, but it all happens kind of in the background, and you link up your other bank account. So in my case, I linked up this Wells Fargo account and deposited, it was some small amount. It was $500 or $800, something like that. It was nothing significant. And they send me an ATM card, which is wonderful, right? So I have this debit card. I can use it at any ATM in the world, basically. So in this case, Greece. What's cool is they see any ATM fees that you're charged by the bank, and they actually reimburse them. So you pay no ATM fees, you pay no foreign transaction, there's no fees whatsoever, and you also get the best exchange rate at that given moment. And then the beauty is, you don't need to forecast in advance of your trip what you're going to need as far as currency goes. You just, hey, I need some more money, I need some more actual currency, let me just go walk over to the ATM and get some out. So yeah, I think this solves every problem for me, and I just feel dramatically better. And yeah, when I chatted with the Schwab rep, they said I would get my ATM card within a handful of days. So yeah, it's really a win all around.
I can't think of a segment that we've done up to this point in time that has left me feeling more irritated, Brad. There's zero chance that I'm going to go to Greece and not be a slightly resentful of this more optimized path you took, unless you can't find an ATM anywhere. In which case, I have some cash that I can lend you, brother, but I'm going to charge you some serious transaction fees.
Nice. A good 12% like Wells Fargo.
Cost of doing business, my friend. Cost of doing business. But yeah, okay. I hope that was helpful. I'm glad to take one for the team. Maybe I even have a little bit of room to nip this in the bud and get this before we actually are in Greece. Who knows? But I think that I acted out of haste, and I should have just slowed down and found out what you were scheming in the background, because that sounds like a way better plan. I will say that I have I did not do very good on this end, on the foreign side, but domestically, I have a online bank account with USAA that gives me free checking. You just got to put $25 in minimum deposit. I can't speak to the interest rate. I'm sure it's garbage just like everywhere else, but they do let you, because they don't have any physical locations, they will let you use any ATM in the country, and they'll refund you up to $15 a month in ATM fees. All right, well, let's go and take a few minutes and talk about this past week's episode on Monday. What this was for me is both a cautionary tale in PSLF, public student loan forgiveness programs, but also, frankly, this hyper debt, getting a degree at any cost. I think today I wanted to slow down and talk about it a little bit further because there's a lot here. And I think it's indicative of maybe a larger problem that you see at a societal level.
Yeah, Jonathan, at a societal level, that's a really deep point. This was distressing to me. I mean, aside from the fact that Sam has $500K in student loans, obviously she made a decision. And I get that on a personal level. But man, when you look at these programs and you say that a dental school costs $135,000, or I think she said the low end, it's $108,000 for tuition plus all this other stuff. And basically these graduate plus loans allow people to borrow these enormous sums. I mean, on some level, I get it, but man, that is a lot of money. And you wonder how much, I don't know, perverse incentives come into this where these schools know that these students can ultimately borrow almost indefinitely. So why wouldn't they raise the price? And if people keep paying it, if this is just the cost of doing business and they're filling up their classes, I don't know why they would have an incentive to stop raising the price, which, I mean, again, it's really distressing when you think about it. But the question I asked Sam was, so you mean every dentist in America is basically going, not orthodontists who have even more years of schooling, but every dentist in America is spending somewhere in the vicinity of $350,000 to $500,000 just in their four-year dental school? And she said, yes. Jonathan, did you have any idea? I mean, you're more in this world than I am, certainly, with pharmacy school and such. Did that ever cross your plate that this is real?
Yeah, there were a couple things that really stood out to me. One is I was shocked at the average income, like what she was telling us in terms of income. And I know she said there's a range, but the economics of that choice are so stark. When she said, right now I'm currently making $120,000, to put that next to that debt to income ratio, my jaw, I had to pick it off the floor. And I knew as a pharmacy student, I knew across the street, the dental students were paying more. I suspected that if pharmacy, you were coming out in between 150 to two, with dental school, you were coming out in between two to three. But I also thought the dentists were making more as well. I suspected that it was on the higher end of that range and it would at least be comparable, if not equal, to kind of a pharmacy path. Nothing prepared me for the numbers that she shared with us. And it made me angry, not for her, not for even the students that are in these programs, but just basically the fact that at some level, individuals, people, human beings are being taken advantage of and they are trapped in student loan debt, which frankly, in most cases, in like 90% of cases, can't be bankrupted. This one choice that you made when you were virtually a kid, you are stuck with for 25 years if you're following this PSLF path. And the fact that, like you said, there's this perverse incentive for schools to just let anyone get the degree because they know that they'll be able to get into this program. They know that they'll be able to finance a virtually unlimited amount of money. And then they know that that can't be discharged in bankruptcy. And that essentially these people are going to be in this program for 25 years with at some point the promise being that it is forgiven by the taxpayer. It just left me irritable for the rest of the day. Now, I'm not one of these guys that just comes down all in with this is what needs to be done. I'm very much a take individual responsibility, but in my mind, it would put a smile on my face to know that we could starve these programs that are trying to charge this insane amount of money. Knowing that she could have saved $100,000 by going across the street and knowing that, you know, if you have a level of financial literacy, if you understand the economics of that, you could make an alternate choice. It just makes me want to go on the warpath, on the campaign trail to say to people, hey, that's crazy. Don't do that. Come over here where it's still sane. You can reach that similar level of income for a fraction of the cost. And it's not, this isn't like an anti, this is not the anti-dentist show, right? This isn't about dental school or not dental school. This is about, if your only choice is dental school, but you can choose from all of the schools, what would actually make sense? What would make sense to lay out a plan that allows you to both follow your passion, if that's dentistry, and still achieve a very, very strong financial ground game, not 30 or 40 years from now when you have to pay that tax bomb and you're on the other side of that forgiveness. Sam is on a path to 10 years. It's going to be 10 years before she ever really is able to keep a dollar of what she's making and start applying it towards her future. And I'm so impressed by what she's actually done up to this point. It makes my path look easy compared to what she is actually accomplishing. So there are some incredible people that are going to come out on the other side. And frankly, there's some people that are going to benefit from PSLF, and that's fine too. But I was talking to our good friend, Brian, who we interviewed in the Unique Advantages of the Individual Investor. I believe it's episode 75. It was a great episode. I was talking to him as an aside, and he said, there is an underwritten rule that when things are unsustainable, they just can't go on forever. Healthcare simply cannot go up by 10% year over year over year. It can't happen. At some point, it would envelop the entire economy. And in the same vein, tuitions cannot go up year after year in an unlimited manner. At some point, we have to say, that's insane. You're out of line. The economics don't make sense, and I'm not going to go there. But a big piece of that is getting the compound math, the just very, very simple equations, basically being able to do this cost analysis upfront and say, that's crazy. And at some point, you guys are going to have to start reducing your rates. But until you do that, not only am I not going to go here, but I'm not going to let anyone I care about in my social circle go here without me telling them up front they need to look across the street. I mean, this is systemic, man. This isn't just Sam. This isn't just Mike Maru, who's in the mainstream news. Every single person that gets into that school, unless they're inheriting a vast percentage of wealth, is going and knowing that they're never going to pay these student loans off. And that's okay. They're just going to pay the minimum. I'm just simply not cool with that.
Yeah. No, I hear you. And it's tough. And I mean, realistically, Jonathan, it starts with education. It starts with second generation FIRE, like we're always talking about here, trying to explain to your kids what makes sense financially. Sam was so wonderful to come on and was such a great guest and was so vulnerable here. And Sam is doing what she's always wanted to do. She wanted to be a dentist at 8 years old. She wasn't thinking about how much dental school costs or even how much dentists make. She said she wasn't even sure or how many loans she had to take out. She just simply wanted to be a dentist and help people. It distresses me to no end that dental school is going to cost $500,000 for basically every dentist you see on every corner in America. That just doesn't make sense. But I mean, the fact that she's saying everyone told her, right? Quote unquote, everyone told her it wasn't possible to pay this down quickly. And you basically just had to wait it out 25 years to get it written off through the IBR program. She said, I don't know anyone who is paying it off aggressively. So Jonathan, what happens is they basically just signed up for 25 years of paying as little as possible, which as I understand it is 10%, I guess, of your income. Then they have this humongous tax bomb 25 years later. She said that her debt would have grown to over $1 million. And then I think she quoted $400,000 in taxes. I guess she's just kind of back of the envelope math here of, oh, I assume my marginal tax rate with Fed and state would be about 40%. So $400,000. I mean, who has that money just lying around to pay this tax bomb? So I just wonder what's going to happen 20 plus years from now or 15 to 25 years when many of these people ultimately have that tax issue. It's really concerning. And yeah, like you said, this is a societal issue, and obviously we're not going to solve it here today. You and I just kind of lamenting this, but man, I mean, maybe by education, right? Maybe by talking to our friends and getting more people in this FIRE movement and understanding finances, maybe that's our way to help.
I think it's a big part of it for sure. And the other half of that equation is the earning potential. You know, there are degrees that maybe you come out with 300, 400K of student loan debt, but there's a path to make 700. Like I get the economics of to some degree of that choice, right? I mean, it's a horrific amount of debt, but you're making this insane income on the other side. Dentist, my understanding is there's a couple paths. You can just go into another practice, right? As an employee, that's probably going to be somewhat of the lower end of the spectrum. You can buy a practice, which maybe someone is aging out. They want to bring someone in. And maybe you slowly get an increased piece of the ownership. Maybe you start your own practice, which means it's not just the student loan debt, but it's also purchasing equipment. The equipment that a dentist would need to start with, I believe conservatively, is $250,000 of business debt that you would need to start up. And so I do know dentists that have their own practice that make $700,000 a year. There is a huge swing on this, but it's certainly not everyone. So anyways, coming back to this, Sam, what she is doing is incredibly tough and difficult. And like, she has my full support, and I'm blown away by her story and what she's going to accomplish. And she is going to be in great shape. But I think what this episode was is a cautionary tale on hyper debt. We know this. We know that it's not student loan debt at any cost. We know that the job isn't always worth it. I think that this is an extreme case of why, of just paying attention to the math and not trusting that just by having the degree, everything's just going to be okay, because it's just not, my friends. It's really not. You need to have a game plan going into this. No one cares about your finances as much as you do. And it's certainly not the admission office at the school. You just can't count on them to have your best interests at heart. They're not bad people. They don't care about your life the same way you do. There's not incentive alignment there. And Brad, she's got a path here, and I suspect that it'll actually be shorter than what she is even now anticipating. But I hope that we're still on the air so that when she does hit debt free, she can call back and we can share that moment with her, because you will know that, oh my goodness, she worked for it, man. She absolutely worked for it.
Yeah, Jonathan, we are definitely going to be on air that day when Sam comes back and says she paid that off. That's going to be a very special moment. So yeah, so certainly stay tuned, everybody. And yeah, it's neat to highlight when people get out of debt. This actually reminds me, I saw a Facebook post by Jim a couple of weeks back where he got 1,100 likes on this, Jonathan. I've never seen anything like this. He said, as of today, I'm 100% debt-free. This seems like the only place that it's appropriate to brag about it. And then I guess what's cool is with the comments, he said, edit, this group has convinced me to post about it on my personal page. Hopefully this goes well. And what a neat thing. He shouldn't be ashamed of that. He should be so incredibly proud. And yeah, to have our community to share it with, and then who knows who he's going to inspire in his own personal life, right? So a huge congratulations to Jim on becoming debt-free.
You know, and I think it just speaks to this idea of just getting a little bit better and being a little bit more informed every single day. And we got a call from Jordan talking about how he was able to leverage the information he learned in this community to drastically reduce the fees in his retirement plan.
Brad and Jonathan, Jordan here. I'm a huge fan of your podcast. I'd like to consider myself a third generation FI member. Both my parents and my grandmother achieved financial independence by frugal living on a modest income. I took these beliefs and incorporated them in my life, but your podcast has given me clarity and direction with my savings. I don't know if I'll use the RE part, the retire early, of the FIRE movement, but it's always good knowing it's an option. I wanted to share a frugal win with you this week. Recently, after listening to many of your podcasts regarding 401k fees, I spoke with my employer regarding our plan and the fees, which seemed a little bit high. She said she'd speak to the plan administrator and see what could be done. Due to this discussion, they realized that there were some administrative charges that were being passed along to the participants. My employer agreed to cover these charges, which will reduce the fee to the participants, maximizing our value. Now, I realized that not all employers would be willing to do this, but for a very simple conversation, it will save participants of our plan many thousands of dollars over the lifetime of their investments. This was due to you and your podcast, so I'd like to send a huge thank you to you and the Choose FI community. And I appreciate Brad and Jonathan, all of the work that you do. Thank you, and keep up the good work. Take care.
This is amazing that it was literally a 5 or 10 minute conversation that had your employer coming back and saying, huh, wow, great catch. And yes, we can do something about this. I mean, how many little outliers are like this that if you start looking for them, you can drastically, drastically improve your performance just by reducing the fees? Forget what actually happens with the market. Your fees are lowered. You're locking in a better return.
Yeah. So Jordan, the third generation FI member, and this great community member who's helping other people. And they don't even realize, probably. All these people in his company don't know that he heard about this through the FI community, through Choose FI, and then went to his administrators and got this lowered. They just know. And they might not even know, frankly, right? But he knows that he's saving people thousands of dollars across his entire company. What an amazing thing. So yeah, well done, Jordan.
We get a lot of these tips over time. That's what we talk about, this being a crowdsourced show. That's really what it comes down to. There's no way that all the information that's presented on this show could just come from Jonathan and Brad. Our experiences are just not broad enough to be able to encompass all the ideas that have been presented here. But thankfully, we don't have to. Everybody in this community has a slightly different take on life, right? Their own particular path. And we've been sending out this message to our email list. Hey, what is the biggest challenge that you expect to face? And we got this response from Jennifer. She says, hi, I'm a huge fan of a podcast. I migrated over from the Mr. Money Mustache forums to Travel Miles 101 to the Facebook page to the Choose FI Facebook page and then found the podcast. I even used the information from episode 69R on how to start a blog. And then I started my own this week. Hers is at happinessgratis.com. There'll be a link to it in the show notes. Our single greatest obstacle to financial independence is health insurance coverage. I am an individual with a chronic autoimmune condition and will have lifetime expensive medication cost. This chronic condition developed the year I turned 40. Prior to illness, I was the poster child of health, a marathon runner with 3 times a week boot camp style fitness classes. I consumed healthy, balanced meals. I would never wish a chronic illness on anyone, but I do feel there's a certain level of naivete in this space when it comes to planning for healthcare in the future. A cancer diagnosis or an autoimmune condition can change a financial landscape in a split second. Now, I'm thankful for an employer who offers amazing healthcare benefits currently. I'm equally thankful that I'm aware of this chronic condition prior to leaving the working world, and we have adjusted our FI budget accordingly for the worst case scenario. But this for her is one of the biggest challenges that she expects to face. And I think it's something that we see pop up, that black swan, that what if. I know what my situation is now, but what could happen in the future? I think she has an excellent mindset surrounding this condition that she is going to be living with for the rest of her life. We got a voicemail from Kara, which I think adds a lot of insight to how to plan for this possibility. Or maybe you already have this. So it's not, will it happen? You know, you're living with a chronic health condition and you're trying to figure out, how does that affect my FI number? This voicemail, I think, will be beneficial.
Hi, Brad and Jonathan. My name is Kara. And I wanted to say, first of all, thanks for creating Choose FI and tying all these people and resources together. I've learned a lot in the past few months about personal finance, and I largely have you two to thank for it. I want to tell you about a few things that I've been reflecting on as I plan my own FI journey and listen to others in the Facebook group. Specifically, I want to discuss chronic illness. I myself have a chronic disease that could strike at any time and require major surgery, require drugs that cost $5 figures a month, or make me unable to continue working at all. Happily, I'm currently in remission, but I'm not alone in this. Many people have chronic conditions. Chronic here meaning basically incurable. Many people have diabetes, heart disease or its precursors, they have infertility, mental health issues, all of which can be suddenly crippling. I suggest that those with chronic illness first get a good disability insurance policy. I know we in the FI community typically despise financial salespeople, and so do I. It's hard to find a disability insurance salesperson who doesn't seem to want to scam you into whole life insurance or a similarly disastrous product, but grit your teeth and buy a disability insurance policy because you need to mitigate risk surrounding your own most fragile and yet fundamental asset, your health. Secondly, I recommend that those with chronic or incurable illnesses aim for fat FI and take on no extra risks on top of well-established market risks. I have a strategic asset allocation. I'm using almost entirely paper assets. I'm aiming for a 3% withdrawal rate, and I'm planning to use some of the strategies that Big Earn lays out to mitigate sequence of return risks. Third, I recommend that those with chronic disease take excellent, uncompromising care of themselves. Using myself as an example, my disease can be associated with need for liver transplant. My work in the medical field has taught me that they don't give livers away to just anyone. They look at whether you've been to doctor visits, whether your blood work indicates you exercise and eat a good diet, and even whether you've kept your dental appointments. So I do all those things, even if it means spending a little extra. I also have a traditional healthcare plan, not a high deductible health plan in an HSA, because I never know when the hammer will drop. There are a few things I could tack onto this. Having a spouse who can work certainly helps mitigate some of the risk of having a serious chronic condition. Some chronic conditions, such as type 2 diabetes and hypertension, are lifestyle related, and you can drastically improve and in the early years perhaps even reverse those things. And finally, it's very beneficial to stay close to your healthcare provider when you need a lot of healthcare, so geo arbitrage might be limited for your own safety. My aims for FI, I should be FI in 7 years, fat FI in 10, so it's possible. I don't leave this message to be a Debbie Downer, but to show that even limits like poor or fragile health don't need to stop you from getting to FI. Not unlike living in a high cost of living area, having a low income job, or having kids, below average health does not need to put a damper on your enthusiasm towards FI. Hope this is helpful to some of the listeners. You've certainly been helpful to me. Thanks so much and keep doing what you're doing.
Brad, was this helpful?
Oh my goodness. That's incredibly helpful. Wow. Yeah. I mean, obviously I have nothing valuable to add other than, wow, thank you, Kara. The only thing I want to say is I love how she's thinking ahead and she knows the rules. Think about what she said with, if I need a liver someday, right? Which is obviously not inconceivable based on the disease that she has, but she knows the rules of, wow, what would make my chance of success higher? And she's doing that years in advance. That is a brilliant, brilliant strategy. And it fits in so perfectly with our FI mindset of looking down the road, understanding the rules, and leveraging them to your absolute benefit. So well done, Kara.
The other thing is you could hear her outrageous optimism, and it's balanced by a strong grasp in reality. That is, I think, one of the biggest criticisms that we've seen of the FI community is that our outrageous optimism isn't balanced out. I think we're outrageously optimistic because we understand the rules. But what I also loved about this is just the balanced perspective, the fact that this isn't just for single white male engineers that have no pre-existing health conditions in the west side of the coast. Like, you know, if there's this bias that, oh, that's who this is for, it's simply not true. That may be who rose to the top and got some publicity first. Our Facebook group, with close to 30,000 people in at this point, is, I think, actually 52%+ female. And then you could say, oh, well, you can only do this if you don't have any pre-existing conditions. No, no, my friend. There are people from all walks of life that are pursuing this path to financial independence. And it may look different. It may look different for them at the perimeters, at the periphery, due to their own unique life circumstances. But the core tenets are the same. And I think you start with the core tenets. And then you say, okay, what variables will affect the life that I want to live? Knowing what I know about myself, what else do I need to guard for? And that's why this can't just be the Jonathan and Brad show. If we're truly going to highlight all the paths to financial independence, we need your insight. We need your input. And Kara, we're so grateful for you weighing in for that. I guarantee you there are tens of thousands of people that will benefit from you being willing to share how you're dealing with your own reality. Thank you so much.
And as always, if you have information that you think would be useful for the community, please send it in to us. Send us an email, feedback@chooseify.com. We can read it on the podcast. Send in a voicemail. Just go to our homepage. You'll see very clearly, leave a voicemail in a number of different places. So send in your information. The community needs your input.
All right, guys. Now, this episode's coming to you from us while we are actually in Greece for about another week. But the reason I bring that up is because so many people in our community are not interested in just taking a 1 week trip, but possibly a multi-month, multi-year trip around the world. And one of the things they've asked, okay, I can do the travel. And I see what you guys have talked about with regards to getting my travel for less, but what other options, what other strategies would be beneficial? What other places would be beneficial to explore if I wanted to do a multi-month, maybe even possibly travel for a year overseas? Great thing is, again, crowdsourced, right? There are people from our community that are doing this. Jared let us know that him and his girlfriend are on a 6-month trip, and I believe their total cost is like less than $6,000. I mean, it's just insane. So we knew we wanted him to come on the show. And fortunately, we are not limited by geographic locations. So basically working as a physical therapist, and I don't want to spoil it, but the end game here is that he is now doing a 5-month trip around the world, going to hit 11 countries. And I think he's saying that his expected expenses are going to be about $6,000. So I've definitely heard people mention in the past, you know, I want to travel the world, but it's so expensive. I don't know if I can afford that. The reality that strikes me is that it would be more expensive for me to stay in my current life now than to travel the world. So really excited about this segment. And with that, Jared, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about this. I mean, so tell us a little bit about your backstory that got you to this point. Have you reached financial independence?
I'm very close. I guess I'll start back. I graduated with my doctorate in physical therapy in 2015. From that point, I've been traveling around the country, most of the time in a fifth wheel camper, taking temporary assignments. At this point, I'm probably at about 20 times my future expected expenses, a little over 25 times my current expenses, but very, very close at this point.
Jared, you graduated from PT school in 2015. Is that what you said?
Yes.
So how are you that far along on the path to FI if you just graduated 3 years ago? Did you have jobs predating that?
No, I've taken these travel assignments. My pay is probably about twice what I would have been as a new grad physical therapist. And since I started working in the middle of 2015, so almost exactly 3 years ago, my savings rate's been somewhere around 90%.
Wow.
So I've just saved pretty aggressively.
All right. Well, let's slow down on that for just a second. So what is a physical therapist? What is kind of the expected pay for that profession?
For new grads, a good starting pay for a permanent job would be somewhere around $65,000 to $70,000.
But you've managed to double that. Tell us about how you found, I mean, you found an outlier. That's basically what we're talking about. When we look at these 80-20 principles, you have found a way to vastly outperform what your peers are making in this profession. It sounds like it's something that's replicable. Tell us a little bit more about this.
Yeah, for pretty much anyone in healthcare, there's travel jobs available, and the pay is much, much better than it is for permanent jobs. And most of the reason for that is these places are desperate for someone to come in temporarily and fill a need. It could be for maternity leave, or somebody quit, or a workers' comp type situation or something like that, or, you know, they just trying to hire someone they can't. And so they pay extra for that. And in addition to that, as a traveler, since you have to leave your home area to go to these jobs, some of the pay that you get is tax-free. When I say that my pay is double, I'm basically taking into account those stipends are tax-free and my net pay is twice what it would be if I was working a permanent job.
That's amazing. So how prevalent are these type of arrangements? Like, can other physical therapists find them? How did you find them? Just talk me through that.
Yeah, they're pretty prevalent. I would say at any given time, there's maybe 300 or 400 open physical therapy jobs, travel jobs in the country. And a lot of them are based on the West Coast. California has a massive amount, probably 100 jobs most of the time. There's quite a few people that do something similar to me, traveling around, taking these jobs. But most of the people don't try to save as aggressively as I have.
That's amazing. So where would someone find that list of these 300 jobs? Is it one central repository for it?
There are travel companies and recruiters that work for those companies that help set you up with contracts. And basically, they'll have a job list of places that need someone. And you work through that recruiter. They set up a contract for you. They basically negotiate with the facility, and they also negotiate with you pay-wise. And it's a pretty easy process on the traveler's end, besides interviewing for the job itself, which usually is pretty simple.
You know, we talk a lot about this idea of earn more, spend less, optimize the difference. It sounds like that's exactly what you're doing in a nutshell. You found a way to double the anticipated income for a new grad, and then you found a way to save 90% of it. Both of those make you an outlier on the respective side of the equation. Tell us a little bit more about what it was like. Was it an obvious choice to go grab a fifth wheel camper? I mean, what was your inspiration from this? It seems like there would be a lot of societal pressure and resistance to this type of living arrangement.
I travel with my girlfriend, who's also a physical therapist, Whitney. We took one contract, our very first one out of school, and stayed in an apartment while we saved to buy a camper. We knew that we probably wanted to do that. And what we found is, one, it's more expensive to find short-term housing because, you know, it's really hard to find a three-month lease. Most people don't want to do that. Also, if you get an unfurnished place, you have to set up utilities and all that, which is a pretty big hassle. If it's furnished, then that obviously comes with an additional premium. And then the other fact is, packing and moving all your stuff every 3 months is a huge hassle. So we assumed that the camper or a fifth wheel would be what we wanted to do. And it turned out pretty good. We traveled in that for 2.5 years before we left for this trip.
So you graduated in 2015. I don't know if you had any type of debt, if you had a positive net worth, but according to what you just said, you've reached 25x your current expenses in 3 and change years. So talk me through like what your current expenses look like, what future expenses. I know you said you're at 20x. Where does the path go from here? And I think that ties into the trip that you're on, right?
Yeah. So in the camper, obviously campground rent, we saved up money for our first assignment while we were saving for the camper. We bought it in cash. And then the campground rent is usually quite a bit cheaper than the short-term housing. So my expenses while traveling were usually not more than around $1,000 a month or $1,100 a month. The campground rent we averaged was probably about $500 a month. And so obviously I split that with Whitney. That includes utilities. So $250 a month for housing and utilities is it's pretty easy to live on, not much. I have been saving, investing since then. I anticipate future expenses to be probably double that, or maybe a little bit less than double that. So I'm saving more towards a higher number just to be conservative because we plan to have kids in the future.
Awesome. So tell us, like, how does this fit into this travel? Tell me a little bit more about where travel falls into your game plans. Because while many people would say, and I think probably somewhat erroneously, oh, I'm going to wait until I've reached financial independence before I do any of the stuff that I've always wanted to do, it sounds like you've actually carved out time in your life to do the things that you really want to do now. And you've done it in a very financially responsible way. How did you get to the point where you were willing to take what it basically equates to half of a year to travel around the world?
Well, taking these travel assignments is very, really conducive to doing international travel because once we finish an assignment, we're unemployed until we want to work again. So it's not like you have to ask anybody for time off. We just finish and then we're done until we want to take another job. So that was a big help. You know, most people can't continue working and take 5 month trips. So we decided, you know, that's a great amount of flexibility we have with our job to do something like that. Also, we're planning until after I was 5 to take a long trip, maybe travel around the world. And then it was actually kind of a spur of the moment thing. My girlfriend I found this resort, this camp retreat thing that she wanted to do, a women's health physical therapy retreat in Morocco. That was in August, beginning of August. I was like, well, you know, if we're going to fly to Morocco, Northern Africa already, then we might as well keep going. I know I want to spend some time in Asia. Most of that's from reading blogs like Go Curry Cracker and seeing how cheap and awesome Asia is. So we decided to, instead of waiting for another 6 months or a year to do it, just to go ahead and do it now. It was already close enough that we had plenty of money saved and investment returns and a little bit of blog income. So I decided to just go for it.
I certainly want to hear all about the trip, but I'm curious, are these going to be little mini retirements? Like, do you enjoy being a physical therapist? Do you plan on working in that profession off and on for years to come? Or is this just a means to an end?
My thoughts have changed a lot in the last 3 years. Initially in school, of course, you spend 3 years in grad school. You assume that's what you're going to do forever. But the job's a little different than I anticipated. I'm more of an introvert. So working around other people all day and talking constantly is kind of exhausting to me. So I don't see it being a job that I'll work definitely forever unless it's in some kind of part-time capacity. And initially when we took this trip, what I was planning was to work probably 6 months a year and then take, yeah, kind of mini retirements 6 months at a time. But now it seems like probably I might work 3 months a year for the next couple of years and then maybe transition to some part-time work because I do enjoy the job. It's just, it's exhausting to work full-time around people all the time for me.
You know, this is something that I've been thinking about and even writing about a lot lately. And that is this idea of designing your future long before you reach financial independence. And I'm blown away at what you've put together here. It's very, very cool. Let's talk a little bit more about this trip that you're making right now. My understanding is 11 countries, 5 months, a total cost you're anticipating of around $6,000. Like how did you put this together?
It was a lot of planning. We started planning this back in December, and we didn't leave until the middle of July. So a lot of it was credit card rewards. The two major flights from the U.S. to our first stop was Edinburgh, Scotland, was free with credit card rewards. And then our last flight is from Hong Kong back to the U.S., and that's free with credit card rewards in December. We used quite a few credit card reward points and hotel reward points for hotel stays in the more expensive places. That's helped a lot. And then the majority of the trip, 4 months, is Southeast Asia. So Southeast Asia is insanely inexpensive. So that's helped a lot, keeping costs down.
What about lodgings and locations? Are you using hotels?
We are almost exclusively using Airbnb besides the hotels that we get for free.
So with the hotels, talk me through what type of points you use in particular. Did you look for certain categories of hotels? I know like Hyatt hotels at category one, they're only 5,000 points a night, or at least on the old Starwood, award chart, it was like 2,000 or 3,000 points per night. And there are a decent number of those hotels in Asia. Did you guys look for hotels like that? Or was it just, hey, we're going to these cities, and if there happen to be hotel rewards, then we use them?
Yeah. So there was kind of a couple things that we used as criteria. One, we picked the cities we wanted to go to independent of where we'd be able to use the points or not. And then also we only used the points if it made sense compared to some of the costs of the Airbnbs in the area. So we planned it so that places like Ireland, Scotland, England, Germany, we would use the majority of our hotel nights there. The points themselves were a variety of points. We used IHG, Hilton. But we each had one free night from IHG. Whitney had a couple free Hilton nights from a sign-up bonus, and all the rest were with points themselves. So if it was a hotel where we had to book with points, we tried to go with the cheapest that we could find with that hotel category. And if it was a free night, we just got the nicest hotel we could find for be able to use redeem that free night.
For the Airbnb, did you try to use rewards points anyway, like using a Capital One Venture card or anything like that? Did that cross your plate?
I had the Barclay card in the past, but recently I haven't gotten any of the cards with those flexible rewards. So no, I really didn't use any of that. But
gotcha.
That definitely would have been something that I would have done if I had the points.
Well, yeah, next trip. So no worries there for sure.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Though he's getting so many countries checked off, he may have nowhere left to go. What about other tips? Do you have any other tips for somebody that's looking to do Airbnb and keep their costs lower because they're doing one of these mega travel trips?
Yeah, definitely. If you can find an Airbnb that offers a weekly discount or a monthly discount, that makes a huge difference. So we spent 28 days in Chiang Mai, and we got a 40% discount for staying there for an entire month. And that's somewhere that we really heard was a great place and wanted to spend a lot of time. So that worked out perfectly. I think it ended up costing us like $11 or $12 a night. So split wow. between the two of us. Another way that I've kind of decreased costs is I keep an eye on Amazon and eBay for any time that Airbnb gift cards go on sale. Occasionally you can get them for a 10% discount, 15% discount. And when that comes up, I really stock up on them. So going into the trip, I had about $3,000 in Airbnb credit that I bought discounted gift cards. So that really helped us as well.
Oh, that's great. And then I had another question about that specifically, because I remember with regards to Chiang Mai, when you were planning this trip, I remember you going into the Chooseify Facebook group and basically asking people for things that you should do while you were in Chiang Mai. I'm just curious, when you were putting together sightseeing activities for the different areas that you visited, what sort of feedback did you collect? And like, now that you've done some of this, what would you recommend that other people do as they're visiting some of these places?
It's kind of a delicate balancing act for me. And I'm really glad that my girlfriend is more liberal in her spending than I am, because she keeps me from just, trying to save everything, being a hermit. So basically, a lot of the places that we've gone, we got recommendations from people that have either been to these cities or, we read on travel websites or something like that. I would definitely recommend that if you're going to take a trip like this and you might only be in these countries once or twice in your whole life, to not really scrimp a whole lot on the activities. So we've done a lot. We've done pretty much everything that we wanted to do in each city. And we more save money on the housing and the travel and sometimes food more than we do on the activities, just so, we don't feel like we missed out on anything.
Yeah, that's cool. What was the neatest thing you've splurged on so far?
In London, we did I think it was called the London Pass or something. I think it was $70 or $80 for a day, but we had access to almost all the major attractions in London. And that was really cool. So we got to go to the top of the Shard, to the Tower of London, the London Bridge experience. We did several different things there. So that's something I normally wouldn't have done, but that was a really cool thing to do.
Yeah, I hear you. It's great to be able to save money on the structural expenses. This is how I look at FI anyway, is you save money on the big structural expenses, in this case, flights and hotels. So you can afford to not worry about scrimping and saving on like the actual experiences. And I know we did this. It's funny, when we were in London, I don't know if you're heading out back that way, but I actually did a trapeze class with my older daughter, Anna, which was the most amazing thing we've ever done. It wasn't that expensive, but it was like, I don't know, $30 or $40 a person. And it was just this really fun thing. It was in one of the major parks right there in central London. And we did flying trapeze. I kid you not. It was a 2-hour course. And it was one of the most enjoyable things I've ever done in my life. So yeah, little tip for anybody going to London. It's a gorilla circus. It's really awesome.
Yeah, that sounds great. That's how I live my normal daily life too, is try to save costs on the big things so that you can splurge on the experiences, because that's always what you remember and is most important anyway.
So you're doing some form of, a long-term travel here. And I know that health and fitness is very important to you. I'm just curious, as you've kind of been, well, actually it's kind of a thread to when you were in your camper as well. Talk to me about the role that health and fitness play in your life, both when you're at home, which for you is mobile all over the country, and now when you're on the road in a different country. Do you find time to, focus on your fitness and your health and your diet? Are you able to maintain some form of routine, since this for you is not something that you're doing for 2 weeks and then you're coming back to normal life? Rather, for the next 5 months, this is your life.
Yeah, it's been difficult. The whole time we've been traveling for work has been difficult for us. In school, we had this pretty easy routine. I got in pretty good shape. I was into bodybuilding for a while. And then as soon as we started working and having to change locations every 3 to 6 months and having to change gyms and find a new gym and get used to the area, it's really easy to put that stuff off. So I've gone through spurts over the last 3 years of taking periods where I really fall off the wagon, and then I really get back into it. As far as this trip, we were in Europe and Morocco for a month, and pretty much every day we were walking 10 to 12 miles, just walking around, seeing everything, trying to save money on transportation costs. And we find the best way to see a city anyway is by walking around. So we didn't really go to any gyms while we were in for that first month, but we got a gym membership in Chiang Mai. And then since we've been in Laos this last 10 days, we found that the gyms here for a day pass is like $1. So we've gone every other day at least, or try to go even more than that. In combination with a lot of walking, it's been pretty easy to maintain.
You know, as you were talking in particular about London and Chiang Mai, it strikes me that there's some vastly different costs between what it would take to live a day in London and what it would take to live a day in Chiang Mai. Tell me like how you did that balancing act between the two.
Yeah, the cost difference is huge. So the way we decided how much time to spend in each place is we figured out what exactly we wanted to do in the expensive cities. And we planned the number of days that we need for that. And then we'd include like an extra day for a buffer just in case one day we didn't feel well or something like that. And then the lower cost areas is where we planned all our like slow relaxation, working on the blog, that kind of stuff. So our month in Europe and Morocco was way more abbreviated in each place, just because obviously, like you said, London is going to cost maybe $60 or $70 a day, where Chiang Mai, I can probably get by for $20 to $25 a day. So we really planned that out to be able to spend more time relaxing in the lower cost areas where we wouldn't have to pay so much for lodging and food and things like that.
I love that. So it's geo arbitrage within a geo arbitrage trip already, right?
Yeah.
So Jared, I guess like my final question to kind of wrap this segment up is just talking about the impact that this trip has had on your life and on Whitney's life as well. So you guys have made this incredible progress. You graduate 2015, 3 years later, you pay off whatever student loan debt you may have had. And on top of that, you're hitting a 90% savings rate. You're doubling the anticipated income for someone that comes out with that path by looking at this kind of outlier way of earning income through travel. And now you've hit this level and you go on this trip and you take 5 months off. But now at some point this trip ends and you come back, and I'm curious, you know, what's next for you? I feel like you have this level of insight in terms of you've been able to build a life that you get excited about. What do you want to come back to?
That's a very good question. And we didn't know going into this trip how we would feel about traveling internationally. We didn't know if this was something that would be sustainable for us or something we would even enjoy. Before 2 years ago, I'd never left the country at all. So this was a big jump for me. But what we found is that this is probably something that's going to be a significant part of our life, maybe 5 or 6 months each year from now on. We're really kind of still on the fence about what the other 6 months might look like. Probably 3 months of that will be working. Maybe the other 3 months will be traveling around the United States or spending time with family. But for the foreseeable future, I think we want to take pretty long international trips at least once a year.
That's awesome, man. Well, let me just, for our audience that's hearing this and maybe hearing about your website for the first time, what is the best way for someone to connect with you and find out more about the content that you've been writing up to this point?
My website is fifthwheelpc.com. I write on there about our domestic travels, our international travels. I've got expense reports I'm doing right now for each place that we're going to. So I'm keeping track of every dollar that I spend in each place and writing regular reports on that. I also write about travel physical therapy. I write about a lot of things on there.
Jared, thank you so much for coming on the show today and sharing your story. This has been great.
Thank you for having me.
You know, Brad, this is the exact type of story that I am so fascinated by. What choices are people making on the path to financial independence? They're not delaying their future. They're saying, this is the life I want to live, and I'm going to look for outliers that allow me to implement these choices now. And I just thought this was, honestly, this may be the best example of that I've seen up to this point.
Yeah. And it's intentionality from the word go. He graduated from PT school in 2015 and was basically able to do this 3 years later after saving 90% of his income, which was already nearly doubled because of this very intentional choice to do this travel work in essence. So it's obviously this theme of travel throughout their entire lives, but what just absolutely brilliant decisions. And now they're at a point where they could work for 3 months of the year and that would more than cover everything and just have their money working for them in the background. Or they could come back home for maybe a year or two, work for a year or two, and then just be done forever. So the beautiful thing here is they have choices. I love that intentionality. That's a beautiful thing to see.
All right, guys. Well, unfortunately, that is going to bring this episode to a close. Now, as you know, we like to finish every episode by doing a drawing for a copy of a book that we have found useful. And there's three books that we offer. The first is J.L. Collins' book, The Simple Path to Wealth. The second is Dominic Cortuccio's book, Design Your Future. And the third book is from Vincent Puglisi's Freelance to Freedom. If you want to enter the drawing, all you need to do is just go to chooseify.com/iTunes. Follow the instructions there and leave us a written review on either iTunes, or Stitcher, then send us an email to feedback@choosefi.com letting us know that you left a written review and what screen name you left it under. And then we give away one book for every 5 written reviews that we get, and we announce the winner on the Friday roundup. Brad, how many winners do we have today?
All right, Jonathan, we have one winner today, and the winner is My Life Hacking Firebug.
Oh man, this was awesome. And they said, one of the great benefits of working night shift is that I get to listen to this podcast as soon as you guys release it on Mondays and Fridays. Thanks to you guys, I have been able to do a spinoff on my financial life and I look at things differently now. I come from a third world country, from a family with very low resources, which led me to attempt a lot of things to provide for my family at a very young age. But I've never stuck to anything. I got discouraged and mostly left things halfway or completely abandoned them. This podcast, along with a Facebook group, has become the push I needed to stay motivated and stay on track. Two regular dudes talking about their life experiences is more relatable than listening to a guru. To be honest, every episode that Jonathan mentions his hobbies, worries, experiences, and lifestyle, I feel more in tune with the show. For example, in the episode that mentions that you guys rather start investing in real estate from a position of financial strength, that resonated so much with me because I started real estate from a position of financial weakness, looking to increase my income, and I lost a lot of money that wasn't mine. In a good note, I follow intermittent fasting and a ketogenic diet. I've lost 30 pounds in 45 days. Wow. And I'm saving $400 a month in groceries. Moreover, I have lowered my $10,000 a year on travel expenses for a family of 5 to my country, the Dominican Republic, and my wife's home state of New York through travel rewards. And I started all of that because it was mentioned on this podcast. Same as growing my own food, and I also recently started my own blog. I feel I do so much by working 11 hours per day on my regular aviation mechanic job, doing all my side hustles in the morning, learning the new skills that those side hustles require, like cinematography, audio, and video editing, that I'm mentally beat by the end of the day. But when I listen to this podcast, it makes me feel that I'm not alone and I'm on the right track. So much to say, but I don't want to make this any longer. Thank you, Brad and Jonathan. Saying that you guys have changed my life is an understatement. Wow, Brad, I mean, you got to respond to this, man. That's incredible.
That is truly, truly incredible. Thank you for leaving that review and thank you for taking action. That's what it's all about. We can talk in this podcast endlessly, but it's all about you listening and taking action in your life, and well, well done.
But that's it, man. That's the rising tide. If this were just a one-way form of communication, just me monologuing for an hour at a time, like I think all of us would be exhausted with it. But the fact that you're willing to weigh back in on what you've actually implemented and where it's sending you in your life, I think it lifts, it elevates all of us. It makes all of us walk away from each individual episode on a high. And so my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth, one life hack at a time.